Money FM 89.3, best of your money. Market View on Money FM 89.3.
It is 4 minutes past nine. Good morning. Asia Pacific markets are trading mixed this morning. In Tokyo, the Nikkei is up 0.5%. The Kospi in Seoul is flat and Sydney is down 0.25%. Investors are exercising caution following a tech-led equity rout on Wall Street overnight. Joining me now to discuss all that and more is Jack Cousy. He is director at the VFS Group and joins us live this morning from Sydney. How you doing, Jack? Good morning.
Twice in 1 week, I must be doing something right, I must say. Get called up twice in 1 week.
Good to speak with you again, Jack. Now, banks and energy counters led a broad pullback on the U.S. markets overnight. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed down more than 470 points. Now, that's a 1.4% loss. It wipes out all the market's gains from last week, and it is also the Dow's worst day in more than 10 weeks. So it seems that inflation anxieties are coming back into the picture, Jack. So why are investors afraid about inflation again?
Yeah, it's an interesting point we find ourselves at in the market. Last night's price action was a little bit interesting to me in the fact that before I went to bed at night, I had a look at the futures, and they were all pointing down, and the Nasdaq was pointing down the worst. And then I woke up this morning to red, but we did see a rally in the Nasdaq on the close and maybe a rotation out of the reflationary and the cyclicals, possibly into tech. Now, tech has been hurt, particularly in that lower end of tech, in that really growthy tech that we saw. And the word inflation is constantly coming up as we go along. In fact, we started to hear the words inflation in maybe August, September last year, because of the excessive spending, the excessive liquidity in the markets, and the broad push in asset prices that we saw that aren't necessarily reflected in CPI figures that we get. And now we're hearing even more rumblings of inflation, and the market is concerned. I think the whole market is concerned, wherever you are, about impending inflation and what that means for stock valuations and how you value them, because we are valuing them on the fact, that interest rates are low, and that's how we're getting some of these multiples. And then what is the response to inflation that the Fed or central banks around the world will have to do? I mean, if it's going to be inflation in the US, it's most likely going to be inflation everywhere around. Now, we haven't talked about inflation for 20 years, and there are a couple of reasons why. We had technology, WhatsApp, phone calls, the internet, which generally brings the price down because you open it to competition, you innovate, and you had a slack in productivity. And you also had the movement of China. I mean, China in the 70s and the 80s brought on this massive amount of cheap labor. They produced goods that no one necessarily wanted to do, and they produced it at a good price, and that kept costs down. So now you've got a number of factors. You've got this enormous fiscal and liquidity that we've talked about, you and I, many, many times. Enormous amount of money that's being dumped in the market, that's being pushed into equities, pushed into housing prices. We've got an enormous savings rate around the world during the pandemic, so they now want to spend as we start to reopen, which is, again, is under question at some point. And you don't have a massive cheap labor market that's coming out of China because their wages have risen. Plus, you've got India in the midst of a pandemic, which is kind of making up for that, and that Southeast Asian belt. And prices are starting to increase. Now, they're not necessarily reflective. I saw Chinese CPI last week. Wasn't that bad here in the U.S., but meat's gone up. Chicken's gone up. Transport goods have gone up. A friend of mine goes to a South Korean buffet, a great buffet here, and he sent me this image of saying, prices have gone up in the buffet from $37.50 to $43.50 because the price of meat has gone up. Now, that's inflation. Now, whether it's creeping up into the data or not is another question, and then asset inflation is everywhere. Property prices, share prices. I mean, that's asset inflation. And the fear of the market is not necessarily just inflation. It's our response to inflation.
Absolutely.
And if I may just continue here on my rant, if the only way you can combat inflation, the short-term mechanism is possibly reduce liquidity out of the market, right? So remove some of this central bank hand. But the central bank is no longer a prominent actor for me in the market. They are the barman at the party with an unlimited bar, open 24 hours, get as much as you want, right? So they're not, they kind of removed themselves from doing that. We talked about this on Monday. You gave me that quote about the punch bowl.
Mm-hmm.
The second way you can counter inflation, really the only way you can counter inflation, is you raise the cost of money. And that's through interest rates, because interest rates is the cost of money. And if you raise the amount it costs to borrow money, you can start to curb inflation. But we have become the drunk at the punch bowl who can't, you know, who can't have his drinks being closed off. And that's the fine line the market is, the central banks are putting. And that's what the market is worried about at this point in time. Mm. And it's starting to get a lot more fear about it as we go along. And that's part of the reason we're seeing what's happening.
Yeah, if I could just piggyback on that response angle that you just raised. In the U.S., petrol prices are rising, and so is the cost of a new car. So consumer good companies are charging more for basic household items, toilet paper, peanut butter, soft drinks. The question, though, is whether these higher prices are temporary or whether they become endemic, as in part of a cycle that leads workers to demand higher wages, and that in turn forces companies to keep raising prices. So what do you think, temporary or potential to become endemic?
And that's the question.
Yeah.
You know, that is the, that's the $64 billion question, is this just a simple spike of inflation because we're reopening and, you know, transport lines and production lines and, you know, export lines are still somewhat broken, or is this endemic? And what you alluded to, Michelle, there is perfect. Prices rise, companies pass on that rise, the consumer goes, he sees a hike, he asks for higher wages. Higher wages lead to more price rises, and that's where you get that cyclical effect of inflation. Central banks have told us that they believe these are only short-term spikes in inflation we're seeing on a year-on-year basis.
Mm.
To be honest with you, I was part of that narrative 3 months ago. I'm still slightly on that narrative, but it is a big concern for me because I can just see it around me. You know, I can see it when I go visit my mother and she complains about the price of fruit and complains about the price of meat all the time.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, she's stopping and, you know, spending. And that's what can happen to an economy. It's that cyclical effect. Unfortunately, I don't have the answer at this point in time. But it's something as investors we need to watch very clearly because it is the biggest risk to this market.
Let me dig a little deeper into that concern that you've raised. So if we take a closer look at markets, there are a couple of basic patterns. When there are inflation fears, tech shares are the first to be sold off and they suffer the biggest losses. Bond yields tend to move higher. The US dollar often takes a hit. So what I want to ask you is this. If an investor is concerned that this inflation narrative really will take hold, where should they put their money?
Yeah. Let me answer the tech question for a moment. I don't believe in that narrative. I think we've seen that short term in terms of looking at the US 10-year, and then every time, you know, it pops above 1.8 towards 2, you see a tech sell-off. If you go back to 16, 17,
mm-hmm.
where we saw elements of inflation and we saw the 10-year rise above 2%, the only sector that worked during that time was actually tech. Now, I believe big tech is defensive at this stage if we start to see inflation. That's where I would go, in my opinion. Maybe some of that growthier tech will get hurt, but I still believe that's actually the place to be. On a broader perspective, if you feel like inflation is going to be long term, you know, it's going to be a lot of pain in the market, Michelle, a lot of pain. And really, your only safe haven, I think, remember, inflation hurts bond yields in the long term because it hurts the return on your money. So you may see a movement out of there. Gold could be an answer because it's a hedge against inflation. And cash could be an answer because, you know, rising inflation means rising interest rates, means you get a better return on your cash, which you haven't seen in a long time. But if we see a movement, think about what the market does when the Fed thinks about it or proposes or even says we might move interest rates up in 2022, 2023, or even 2022, and think about what an actual move in interest rate would look for the market. It would be short-term carnage. I think it would spell, you know, a real big movement in the market, almost a bear market of a 20% fall, because the market would not know how to react to it. You would then find some value, you would then find a floor, and we'd then go back into it. But it is the single biggest factor or the single biggest element that it, that will affect markets going forward. And the young short thing is we just can't see it right. There's a lot of different theories on it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of smart people, a lot smarter than me, have opposing views. But it is a very big risk for the market going forward.
He's Jack Cousy, Director of Strategy at the VFS Group. Now, speaking of pain in the market, Jack, another major topic on investors' minds is no surprise, and that's COVID-19. Over in the US, an average number of cases per day has fallen below 40,000 for the first time since September. Over in India and Southeast Asia, though, case numbers are rising. And here in Singapore, our Minister Lawrence Wong, who co-chairs the government's virus task force, has said Singapore is, quote, on a knife's edge. Case numbers could go either way over the next few weeks. So what I want to ask you, Jack, is how is COVID-19 affecting your investment decisions now? If we look at the numbers, it seems the U.S. market may be a better place to head to despite this week's sell-off. What do you think?
The short-term narrative would be right in possibly saying that. You've got to remember, you know, we talked about excess liquidity. If we continue to see lockdowns across Southeast Asia, you might get, you know, the government step in with enormous amounts of liquidity, which tends to help the stock market. Mm-hmm. It's concerning what is going on. I think India is where the concern for Southeast Asia is, because it borders so many countries, because it has such a large border, and then you get that, you know, spread we know about, this awful virus that's plagued the world over the last year and a half. For me, Michelle, long-term, Southeast Asia and Asia is where I want to be. Mm. You know, we've talked about this a number of times. Mm. This is the center of the world. If you talk about increased regionalism in the world, and we're starting to see that, you know, your North American belt, your European belt, and your Asian belt, Asia is the place to be. It dominates world trade now. It's starting to dominate tech. It dominates chip making through its foundries. It's the largest population. It's the largest land mass. Culturally, it tends to be together. It's the largest trade bloc. When you talk about, you know, production and manufacturing coming back to home bases in terms of advanced manufacturing, it's well placed there. This is where I want to be. This is the center of the world. Mm-hmm. While the Americans have got a good grasp on the virus, I really feel like they've got a lot more things to do. They kind of have a broken country, tend to be very divided. I really feel like, you know, this is a superpower in a slow decline, and that this is the Asian century. And when you talk about the best parts of being in Asia, it's actually through the Southeast Asian belt. It's got an enormous youth population that's coming into the market, mm-hmm. a youth population that, by all figures, will earn more money than their parents and spend more money than their parents, and that's a key factor for economic growth. When you look at the Western world, that millennial growth there, they're actually going to earn less money than their parents, which means economic growth can be somewhat thwarted. So Asia is the center of the economic universe. This is where I want to be long term. They will get under control. We will get more vaccine. We'll start to develop herd immunity. But unfortunately, it's just going to be a tough time for them. But as an investor, think long term and think about, you know, the metrics that make up an economy, and it's made up on consumption, right? That's what makes economies. It's not the rich, it's not the poor, it's the middle class belt that consumes and drives economic growth, and it is best placed to do that with all the metrics that they have. So, yes, a bit of short-term pain, but this is the region of the world that I want to be over-invested in.
All right. Well, thanks for that very thoughtful answer there. As in terms of continuity, COVID-19 concerns recently led us to tighten our borders, but it looks like high-profile economic summit, like officials from the World Economic Forum, they say the summit will proceed as planned from the 17th to the 20th of August. So, you know, we hope there is a certain theme of continuity that will hopefully...
Absolutely. We get that from the I'd like to go, you know what I mean? I'm sure there's some great lunches and a couple of good buffets, and I'm sure the cocktail party would be one to remember, you know?
So, I'm sure the meetings and industry, you know, the meetings industry is going to cheer this one on, for sure.
I will point out something, hear from you. I think we discussed this a couple of weeks ago. You talk about international flights.
International what? Excuse me?
International flights, you know, just for you and I. And I was always a big believer, I think I said this on the show, that, you know, I would be there in September and we'd be hosting Money and Me Live, you and I. Like,
yeah.
Duo. It would be awesome. I just can't see it happening. You just feel like borders, you know, the Chinese in their two sessions, they said they weren't going to open borders to 2022. We had our budget last night, which I think we're going to talk about in a moment. They flagged that international borders wouldn't be open for 2022, and that's at a minimum. And a lot of countries have flagged that. So, you know, whether we're going to be jumping on a 747 or a 737 Air Max or an Airbus A380 anytime soon is in significant doubt. I know that here locally we've had these bubbles on view, you know, proposed bubbles with Hong Kong that have just been shut down at any, you know, spike in the virus. So I worry about the valuations of some of these airline companies and how hard they've got, and that's part of the reason why this reflationary, recyclical trade just doesn't work for me long term right now.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a while till we see global gatherings at scale, of course. But I think, you know, it would be a big morale booster to have the WEF go on as planned. We'll see. We'll keep tabs on that. I want to turn to Australia. As you mentioned, and for listeners who've just joined us, Jack is joining us live on the phone line from Australia. And earlier this week, the ASX 200 hit a record high. Now, it's come off that level a little bit. Yesterday, it closed down about 1%. This morning, I see it's trending lower again. The Australian government, meanwhile, has unveiled a host of new spending measures, this to boost the economy. In broad strokes, Jack, fill us in. How much is the Australian government planning to spend?
Yeah, spent. I mean, we're talking about, I'm just having a look at, you know, how GDP figures. I mean, there's enormous spending. I don't have an exact figure for you. I will have a breakdown on the economic growth. But enormous spending in terms of, you know, women in the market, obviously on the virus, building infrastructure. But in broad, it was quite a good budget for the Australian economy and for the Australian market. And you talked about the strength of our market. It's been a choppy day on global markets here. I'm seeing futures price around. But, you know, they forecasted a 4.25% GDP growth in 21-22, which I think is a phenomenal figure.
Yeah.
Economic growth of 1.25% in 2021, and then we're going to go to 2.5% the following year. I think the unemployment figures, where we saw some real growth or some real, you know, green shoots. You know, we were talking about doomsday predictions of around 8% unemployment in Australia. You know, we're only looking at 5.5% this year, and then next year will be 5 and 4.75, which is pre-pandemic levels, to be honest with you. The deficit was where we saw the real improvement, even with the enormous amount of spending. So the 2021 deficit was revised down by $52.7 billion from 213 to 161. So that's a massive improvement. It's almost 25%, a little bit over 25%. And that's because of the better employment rates. And, of course, you know, the iron ore price is booming here. They also forecasted that they're going to revise down the deficit here by another $29.4 billion. So it was a good budget from a government that I think has done a, you know, pretty good job in managing the expectations of the public and the economy. And I think the market was seeing that, and that's why we've seen a really big push in the Aussie market across most sectors here, with the exception of with growth. So my concern about Australia, if I can just point, is we're going through this massive property boom at the moment. I mean, it's crazy how much markets are going up. In fact, some areas in Sydney are up 16% for the quarter. And we talk about debt. While government debt is coming off, corporate and household debt has really ballooned again. And we go back to that earlier point that I said, if you start to see inflation and you start to see interest rates creep up, we could be a real peril. I believe the property market here in Australia has gone too far. I believe it's in a bubble territory, to be honest with you, Michelle. And the government really has to manage that properly, because you talk about that cycle, property, when your property goes up, you feel richer and you feel better about your economic circumstances, which means you spend more, which then fuels economic growth. And that's part of the reason governments want to underpin some type of property market, because Australians are so heavily invested in it. If that starts to wane, you know, you get that cyclical knock-on effects in the market. So we'll see what goes on, but it's pretty good. Pretty good budget.
So what impact do you think this big spend budget, Australia looking to run the economy hot, what impact could that have on the Aussie dollar?
I mean, when you spend money, you tend to print more money, right, which, you know, negatively affects your dollar in terms of other currencies. But you then counteract Australia being a heavy commodity exporting country. And then you look at the price of commodities. Iron ore is a perfect example. I mean, iron ore was up like 10% 2 days ago in the day. You tell me there's no inflation in the market with commodities going on there. So that's been counterweighed by our move in commodities. But whenever you spend much, you tend to print much, which is not necessarily good for a currency. But then when you look at it against a U.S. counterpart who's spending trillions and trillions of dollars, that might outweigh it. So to be honest with you, I hate a strong Aussie dollar, Michelle, and the reason for that is because I'm invested overseas so much, that affects my earnings overseas. So if I'm invested in Facebook and Facebook's up 2%, if the Aussie dollar is up 2%, that negates my gains and my clients' gains, because predominantly my clients are Australian. So I'm always hoping for an Aussie dollar that's weak. But when you compare it to the US, which is where we're doing it, and then a fixed against China, you've got to think of micro as stronger, particularly with the move of commodities and whether that continues to go higher.
All right, Jack, I promise you we talk about this. I'm going to pivot now to China. In other news, China moving closer to rolling out the world's first major sovereign digital currency. A very high-profile trial has been taking place in Shenzhen. China says a digital yuan is meant for domestic use, but some analysts say that it could eventually undermine the U.S. dollar's dominance as the world's reserve currency. So what has been the reaction to the digital yuan so far by people who've used it? I read Bloomberg, an article saying it's been met with a shrug of indifference. So what do you think?
Yes, I mean, you talked about Shenzhen, so they did trial it in four cities last year, and the expansion of the trial has now gone into regional cities and actually country towns. And I think that's where you're getting a bit of a shrug, because, you know, they're not necessarily as adopted to mobile payments. This is going ahead. Make no mistake about it. You know, this is going to happen. When it's going to happen is another question. My understanding is its treatment in the four cities was quite well received and it worked pretty well. You're talking about, you know, 3 million transactions, nearly $400 million has been spent in the digital yuan. The Chinese are telling us that the first phase will be to remove all M0 money supply. So that's notes and coins, and that will completely be removed out of the system. Now, that's quite easy for a nation that spends 95% of their spending on a mobile payment or on a credit card or on an online system. The question is, how do they roll it out into things like M1 and M2 and your entire money supply? So this is going ahead. Let's examine why the Chinese are pushing forward so aggressively with this, and they've been building this for 4 or 5 years. Firstly, it's costly to produce notes and coins, right? It's a cost. You know, you've got to produce it, you've got to make sure they're not counterfeited, you've got to store it, you've got to distribute it, there's a cost to that. They're going to save some money in terms of doing that. Secondly, we're living in the world of Bitcoin and cryptocurrency. This is the way the world's going. We're moving towards digital currencies. This is not a matter of this, it's just a matter of when that's going to happen. The third reason is I think they want to remove the power out of their big tech firms. So when you talk about the $43 trillion in payments that occur online, I'll say that again, $43 trillion in payments dwarfs the U.S. by nearly 10 to 1. 95% of that is done through either Alibaba or Tencent and then a prolong. So the Chinese can't see those transactions. Sure, they could go in, but it's not in their sector. This suddenly brings an amount of spending in their sector which they can regulate. The other things you can do with things like currencies, you can start to tell people what they can send. You can, you know, use the currency for a specific reason. For example, some of these payments that have gone on in the U.S., you know, these drops of wages, they, let's face it, they've gone into a Robinhood account and, you know, they've spent it on stock or they've spent it on crypto. With a digital currency, you can wire that currency to say, okay, we're giving you money, you need to spend it on food and, you know, healthcare, you know, and that's part of the reason that they're doing it. The other one is they want to circumvent the U.S. dollar. You know, it's been a pygmy for them for quite a long time. They've, you know, hated the fact that they've had to deal with a U.S. dollar-denominated system. If you talk about international transactions, you have to use a US bank or a Swiss bank somewhere along that Swiss system in order to transfer money. And this is a way for them to negate it. If they can build a digital currency that works, that is trustworthy, that moves and does its job, you could simply start to create your own little bubble using the renminbi. They want to internationalize the renminbi. They realize it's key to them becoming, you know, an economically dominant superpower. You know, they understand that 15 to 18% of world trade is done by the Chinese, yet only 1 to 2% is done in the renminbi. They need to fix this. The US dollar doesn't allow them to do that. This is their answer to do it. I think they're running aggressively and they want to be first, is they kind of want to carve out that first mover advantage. And we're already starting to see that. So last year, the Chinese removed all foreign exchange transaction costs for 12 countries, some of them involved in the Belt and Road Initiative, to try to internationalize the movement of renminbi. They are asking countries that are involved in the Belt and Road to accept payments in RMB and to pay interest rate payments in RMB. And my understanding is that they want to install POS systems around these BRI networks in order to start to internationalize the renminbi and use a digital wallet. So this is part of a 10-year plan in a country that thinks 100 years ahead. And I think the urgency is they want to be first and they want to develop their network. And make no mistake about it, this is about circumventing or at least removing their dependence on the US dollar system, which has been used as a long arm by the US for quite a long time.
Yeah. It's been a great deep dive. I've got to leave us here, Jack. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. He's Jack Cousy, Director of Strategy at the VFS Group.
Before acting on the information on Money FM, please consider if it's suitable for your own investment objectives, financial situation, and risk tolerance. To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download our audio app. That's AWEDIO. Available on Google Play or the App Store.